Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and also to Unity FM in Birmingham in the Midlands on 93.5. And last but not least, hello to Radio Verulam in St Albans. Now, we all like a good shrubbery. That's a given, I think. So the theme this week is trees.
Our guests this week are Martin Maudsley, a storyteller, and he's here to tell us a story about trees, tying in with our theme nicely. Julian Parry is going to give us his view on the world this week. We also go back to the Forest of Dean, where recently there was a big rally by Hoof, Hands Off Our Forest. Last week you heard a speech by the Right Reverend, the Bishop of Guildford, Christopher Hill, and this week we hear from Jonathan Porritt, who was also at that campaign.
We'll chat to Tony Gosling later on about the privatisation of forests in this country at the moment. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
It's time for me to welcome Mr. Martin Maudsley. Hello. Hello. You're a storyteller, and linking with our trees theme, you recently told a story in the Forest of Dean, which they're planning to sell off. Tell us a little bit about why you were telling a story in the Forest of Dean and to who.
Well, I've done quite a lot of work over a few years in the Forest of Dean with schools there. And a lot of schools, as you might think, being a rural area, are quite small. And so there's quite close proximity to natural areas and to the forest. So a lot of them are very much shaped by the forest around them. But sometimes, I suppose, children don't necessarily have the opportunity to go out and be amongst the trees, as perhaps they have in the past, or to sort of spend time being creative around trees. So as a storyteller, I use whatever materials are around me. And in the Forest of Dean, we were very much focusing on and using the trees as a stimulation to tell stories, make stories.
So you're a storyteller by sort of living, you know, you pay your rent.
Yeah, it does pay my mortgage, right. As it happens.
How long have you been doing that?
I've been doing it about 9 years. I've started in environmental education, so I came through from working with children and families outdoors, trying to provide opportunities to reconnect with the outdoor world and provide opportunities for learning. And then stories just seem to be a natural vehicle for people to understand things in a holistic way. It touches the heart as well as the head, so there's possibilities to really get involved in a story. And I love stories myself. I have since a child, but that's continued into adulthood.
Yeah.
So it's a good vehicle for connecting
with
people.
What do you find sort of urban kids' perceptions of the wild and forests are, and you know, is it must be quite a pleasure to actually sort of open their eyes to some kind of a new landscape.
But I think at the same time, I think children are essentially the same as we were when we were children. They love being outdoors and they love playing and they love being out amongst trees. But I think the world around them perhaps has been a bit more limited, certainly with things like traffic and opportunities to be outside are more restrictive, I think, for children. But when I get a chance, for instance, tomorrow morning, going back to a school in the Forest of Dean called Steam Mills near Cinderford, and we're going to spend the morning outdoors. And the program of activities that I've been planning with them is to go and spend some time with a tree and to think about, you know, the longevity of a tree. So, for instance, a good oak growing in its prime 300, 400, 500 years perhaps has witnessed a massive change in the kind of, you know, people coming and going, how many generations of children have been and gone in the time that that oak's been alive. And getting the children to think about what the lifespan of that oak is compared to their lifespans, and to sort of think about change on a different scale. And you know, perhaps there has been.
So what, when you told a story, what was your story about? How did you sort of plan, you know, okay, I've got to tell a story?
Extent, because I'm an oral storyteller, I don't necessarily have a script or anything written down. And quite often, you don't necessarily know what story you're going to tell until you meet the children, until the environment perhaps, that you know, suggests something. There's a particular tree, has a particular sort of character to it, and that suggests a story in my mind. It's not exactly a precise science. It's more of a sort
of... So how long a sort of an empty gap of time do you have to fill with your story?
Well, I think stories just have their own length, you know, sometimes. I mean, they tend to be, you know, around 10, 15, 20 minutes a story, that kind of length.
Yeah.
And it depends as well how much audience interaction there is. So sometimes I'll stop the story and I'll ask the children. So, for instance, I tell a myth, so by which I mean a story that explains how the world came to be, but in kind of terms that are more kind of imaginative rather than in a kind of factual or scientific way.
Yeah.
So, for instance, here in Bristol, we know that the story of Avon Gorge was created by two giants called Vincent and Gorham. So there's a myth that explains that the riverbed being created by those two giants digging it out. In this case, I was telling them a story about how trees lose their leaves, and we told the story that there was the mini beast, the creepy crawlies, the insects and the bugs and the spiders were living in this world. Yeah. When the trees kept their leaves all year round, they kept them in the summer and the spring, but they also kept them in the winter. And these little mini beasts underneath the trees were freezing to death. But eventually, and cutting a very much longer story shorter here, the trees were persuaded to drop their leaves and allow those leaves to form a blanket on top of the mini beasts so they kept warm in the winter. So that's
explaining sort of hibernation and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a good point, because you can bring in all kinds of factual understanding, but in the framework and in the context of a story that the children will remember. They might not necessarily remember a series of facts about this and that, but if you tell a story that engages with their imaginations, then they can hold lots of information within the story. So when I asked them to think about what kind of creatures were shivering and freezing on the hard, cold earth before the trees dropped their leaves, then they will come up with lots of ideas of spiders and centipedes and slugs and millipedes and stuff like that. So it's,
I'm imagining kids probably don't know as much about wildlife as they probably did, or, you know, flora and fauna in decades past.
I mean, I think you're actually right. There was BBC Wildlife magazine did a survey that I was slightly involved in about 2 years ago, and they the result from that was that children don't know as much about the wildlife around them as they did. They probably know more about things like dolphins and rare species from the television than they do about the nature that's just around them every day. So part of my kind of feeling is that it's good to get to know the woodlice, you know, under your feet in the forest floor, as it is to get to know the rare gibbon that's in the Madagascan forest.
So why do you think it's important for kids to be able to be in touch?
I think for two reasons. I think, first of all, children get a great deal of enjoyment out of being around nature. I think it's a natural thing for a child to play and to hold and to experience nature. I think having a 1.5-year-old myself, he delights in a ladybird on the end of his finger. It's, you know, source of fascination and joy. But also, on the other side, if we're trying to look after the planet that we live around, I think to have formative childhood experiences are the best way to then, as an adult, have a balanced and proactive and sensible approach to how we look after the planet.
Okay. Did you have sort of quite an active outdoorsy sort of childhood?
Yeah, I was very active outdoors. But I bet if there's a group of fine-looking people around us here, I bet most of them, one or two are nodding their heads, most of us did have those outdoor experiences. And for me, and it'd be interesting to ask other people, they feed me in my adult life. So sometimes in times of stress, or sometimes when I'm trying to be creative, I'll remember a play opportunity I had. I remember climbing a tree, for instance. Quite often I remember trees that I've climbed, and it gives me a kind of, oh yeah, I remember that. That was a good feeling.
I can see a tone coming out. There's great trees that I've climbed,
yeah. Well, in my local park, we've lost a tree that for many years was so bent down at an angle that children could very naturally just walk up and down the tree. So it was so easy to climb. But unfortunately, it keeled over. I think died of natural causes.
Well, tell us a little bit about the storytelling festival. Yeah. You are a storyteller, and there is a whole festival.
There is. We've got 9 days, 10 events, and it's held during National Storytelling Week, which starts on the 29th of January in 2011. We decided in Bristol should be, as much as anywhere, honouring that National Storytelling Week. So we put on a whole deal of events, some for children, some for families, and some for adults as well. So if I'm allowed to give a website, the best place to find that would be bristolstoryfest.co.uk.
bristolstoryfest.co.uk. Absolutely. In the week beginning the 29th of January 2011.
Just so. And hopefully there'll be stories of trees amongst those as well as anything else.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for explaining and telling us all of that. And you have the gift of the gab. You have a silver tongue. I'm sure you must be excellent. Can we see you telling a story at the Bristol?
There will be opportunity to see me.
What will you be telling a story about?
I'm doing a story called Northern Lights, and it's drawing on the kind of stories from the north, from Scandinavia, and from that part of Europe, the Arctic Circle, where there are Valkyries and polar bears.
Do you know what day that's on?
That's on the Wednesday, so I believe that's the 2nd of February.
2nd of February. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With the themes as trees and forestry and all things shrubbery, Tony Gosling, our very own, would like me to do a quick question and answer with him regarding a topic which you will have seen in the press quite a lot lately, or possibly not. Maybe it should be in the press more. Forest privatisation. Tony, hello.
Hi, John.
So, what do we technically mean by a forest, and what do we mean by forest being privatised?
Well, forests go back hundreds and hundreds of years, right back to medieval England, where they were basically royal land, which was set aside specifically for the king and his immediate friends. And the idea was that every year the king would try and visit most of the forests in his kingdom once a year.
Large
tracts of land which were generally speaking, woodland, which were completely the property of the king, and nobody else was allowed to use them.
Okay, so that was the birth of these as legal sort of areas. Okay, well, why are these legal areas now being gotten rid of? Or
well, there are all sorts of questions over why such an important public asset should be being privatised. Probably the most important is that it then means that we can't have a strategic view of our wood supply. For many centuries, it's been understood that the government needs to take a hand in making sure that there is enough wood for the country to use if it needs to and when it needs to. And the privatisation will actually mean an end to all that, where the individual owners decide whether the trees are grown or not, rather than the government. And obviously the government took over that role pretty much the time of the English Civil War from the king.
Right. I mean, do we need to be scared about this? I mean, who are they selling off to? Are sort of agreed parties, quangos, private public partnerships, or, you know, PGL?
Well, it's just to the highest bidder. I'm afraid this is the way these things work. Whoever's got most money, that means obviously possibly foreign corporations, foreign individuals, as well as companies in Britain. And the big worry for me is that this is likely to mean a decrease in public access to these places and a lack of investment in the infrastructure, that is the footpaths and that kind of thing, because a lot of private owners simply don't see the public access side of forestry as of any importance. They just see it as an investment. Maybe they're taking their money out of the stock exchange and putting it into the forest.
I mean, is this possibly not an arrangement whereby, you know, it may not necessarily go to the highest bidder of that is abroad? It will all go to, you know, sort of aristocratic types, and they all sort of take back all the land that
well,
was
they may
originally
be,
owned by the royal family.
Well, they may
place.
Be the highest bidders in some cases, but largely now the British aristocracy is nowhere near as powerful as the big corporations and the merchant classes. So it's more likely that this is going to go simply to the highest bidder, which will be companies and possibly rich individuals.
Okay. What can we do about this, if anything?
Well, most importantly, there are several campaigns going around about it. There's the big one we've heard about in the Forest of Dean. But then there are also groups like the Ramblers Association are also campaigning to make sure that we retain access to these forests.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about landowning of old. I mean, you've obviously done some research into this. I mean, how were landowners traditionally allowed to keep people off their land in these forests, and when did they cease to have that ability?
Well, around about the time of the enclosures, which was the 100 years or so around the English Civil War and a little bit after that, land was privatised. So, and when it was privatised, as it was enclosed, this meant that it was considered to be the private property of the landowner. And you might find it shocking, but back in the 1700s, it was actually legal for landowners to put man traps down and things like spring guns, where if you actually walked into a piece of wire, it would fire a gun at your head and this kind of thing. So thankfully, that's all been banned now. But it looks like what's happening is that a lot of this land, which is now forest owned by the state, is now going to be going to private hands, and we're going to see the keep out notices going up across the country.
Okay, well, Tony Gosling, thank you for alerting us about that.
The Forest of Dean community is alarmed at the prospect of government selling off the Forest of Dean. Hands Off Our Forest, or HOOF, is the campaign group fighting the proposals. It's a broad alliance of groups and individuals. And what it's fighting is the coalition government, who are pushing through a public bodies bill that will, according to the minister, fundamentally reform the public forestry estate with diminishing public ownership and a greater role for private and civil society partners. Now, this bill is being rushed through Parliament and may even receive royal assent by the middle of 2011. This basically means the Forestry Commission is selling off the land of the Forest of Dean. One outcome could be private firms buying the land of the Forest of Dean and using it for open-cast quarrying, which would devastate the area. The government says that public rights of ways and access won't be affected by the new bill, but there are very few designated public rights of access to the forest anyway, and this might not be guaranteed under new ownership. Last week, there was a rally in the Forest of Dean outside of Speech House, and notable speakers included Jonathan Porritt, with support from David Bellamy. Dialect's Anthea Page was there to see the wooden structure of the House of Commons go up in flames and to ask people how they felt about the new bill.
So let's go over to the Forest of Dean to hear the speech given by Jonathan Porritt. This was recorded by Alec Milne, and afterwards you can hear some local people's views about the new bill, as well as the burning of Big Ben, no less, recorded by Anthea Page.
The hedgerows and ditches have gone. You tell us that's progress, you had to move on.
We've got someone from outside of the forest now who's going to support us, Mr. Jonathan Porritt.
Not that far outside the forest. From Cheltenham. I thought I'd better come clean on that quickly. We moved to Cheltenham 20 years ago, and from that point on, we've been regular visitors to the forest. have enjoyed everything it has to offer, have loved the sense of this being a living, vibrant community in more ways than people can begin to imagine. A living, human community, first and foremost, as well as an ecological community that has massive value that I think a lot of people understand when they get a chance to get to know it. For us, being this close to the forest has been an incredible privilege, and I feel very privileged to be here today, to have been invited to speak on behalf of this campaign, the Hoof Campaign, to see what needs to be done now to protect the forest and ensure that this government's irresponsible, insane plans do not go ahead. I think we're very lucky to have a protagonist like Jan Royal in the House of Lords who can speak up on behalf of this campaign in a place where her words and your words through her will be listened to. She reminded me of a lot of the key elements of this campaign that is already emerging. Firstly, do not be seduced by the siren words of Mark Harper, the Forestry Minister, or anybody else in this government when they tell you that everything will be all right once you get to see the white paper. That is just a whole farrago of lies, lies, and lies. We know what the intention of this government is now. They've made it very clear, even though not all of it has come out yet in the public domain, they would like to see as much of the public forest estate sold off into private hands as fast as possible, with as big a receipt coming back into the treasury as possible. Every time they talk about private forestry, they mention civil society and the big society in the same breath. We know, and that is absolutely clear in the Forest of Dean, we know that this idea of selling off little packages of land to community or voluntary groups makes no sense whatsoever. As Jan said, the Forest of Dean is a whole. It is an entity in itself. It's a living, breathing organism, which you can't just parcel off into little bits and hope that those who are left with managing those little bits will understand the value of the whole. It is extraordinary to me that we have a government that still doesn't understand the basics of land management at that very fundamental level. So we know now that there is a fight on. There are some people in the UK, some people in England today, who think the government is going to get the right balance when it comes to the public forest estate. I was talking to some friends near the Isle of Wight and up into the New Forest the other day, and they seem to be rather more relaxed about what's going on in the bill and the white paper than we are here in the Forest of Dean. I think relaxation is just one stop short of complacency. I don't think we have any basis on which to trust anything that we hear from this government at the moment. And this kind of action today, this kind of rally, this kind of expression of very direct public anger is a critical part of persuading this government, and Mark Harper in particular, that they shall not move forward with this proposal. There are defining moments for all governments. When the Labour government was elected in 1997, it could get away with practically whatever it wanted to begin with. In 2000, for the first time, it made a massive error. And you will, I'm sure, recall the fuel tax protest that seriously destabilised the government at that time. It was a shock to their system, a shock to their sense that they could do no wrong. And there was, from that point on, a vulnerability and fragility about the Labour government which surprised everybody. Now, as it happens, I didn't really support the fuel tax protests because I think we are going to have to be much more intelligent about the way we use fossil fuels because of climate change in the future. But that was a defining moment. My instinct is that we're going to be doing a lot of campaigning over the next few years for all sorts of different reasons, because of what we've begun to hear from the new coalition government. But maybe this is the defining moment, the point at which people say, this is not right. This is not the proper way to proceed. And if this campaign here in the Forest of Dean becomes the symbol around which people begin to rethink what it is that we want from our government, then it'll be a great deal more powerful than Mark Harper and his colleagues currently believe. So, that's really all I have to say today. I just feel very empowered to be part of this. I spent 35 years of my life campaigning for one cause or another. Some of them have been unwinnable, some of them have been winnable, some have been against the odds, some have been with the odds. All I know is that this is a campaign that has at its heart the integrity and spirit of a massively powerful group of people, which will undoubtedly win the day. More power to all of our elbows. Thank you.
How have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now, and the children are showing us how.
Hello.
What's your name?
Cliff Bryant.
Cliff, what do you think about the campaign?
I think it's terrible. It's like a lot of things these days. We've got a big problem in Malvern where an American company's bought our Malvern water factory and they're going to flatten it and build houses on it. And it's something that's been there for donkey's years and it's going to disappear. And the same's happening. Land's End is another example, isn't it? Look at the state of that now. So, yes, it's a good cause. We come from Malvern to support it.
That's really good, coming all that way. What about you?
We're from Gloucester, and we've got family in the forest, and we come to the forest all the time, and I think it's absolutely diabolical that you could sell off this forest. And all the people who enjoy it, and it's open to everybody, it's beautiful. And, you know, they're selling off the whole country. I mean, it's not just here, there's other forests around, but this one we're fighting for. We need more people, actually.
Yeah.
To support it.
I don't think enough people know what's going on, so they need to write letters and come out and demonstrate.
Well, it's the typical Tories, isn't it? They know the price of everything but the value of nothing. And selling off the forest isn't going to bring the deficit down. It's just dogma that they want to do it by, and that's the only reason. Same with all the other cuts. The poor, the weak, the sick, the disabled, they're all going to take the cuts. Why? Because that's the easiest thing the Tories can do. All their mates, the bankers, will get away with it. And that's what we're fighting against as much as anything, not only to save this forest here, but, you know, against the whole Tory dogma of, you know, cutting back on, you know, what we expect from a civilised society.
Why are you here today?
Why am I here? Because I don't want to see the forest privatised. It's been ours for about 1,000 years, and I think it should stay that way.
Do you live in the forest then?
I don't now. I live in Newent, which is outside the edge of it. But I was brought up in the forest. I brought up in Cinderford. So,
what about you, sir?
Same reason as my uncle here. It's showing some support against this threat of a sell-off. And great to see so many people out here today with the same strong feeling.
You think you'll win?
I'd like to think so, and I think with Jan Royal on our side, we've got a very good chance.
But Pa could be safe and be free. Use the sun and the wind and the sea. So why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now. And the children are showing us how.
So we're standing in front of a very large wooden structure with the face of Big Ben painted on it, like the Tower of Big Ben, and they're about to set fire to it to show defiance to Parliament over the land issue. You can hear someone singing a lament to the forest in the background. So they're lifting some timber now towards the structure, and I think any minute now it's going to go ablaze. Hello, girls.
Hi.
Why are you here today?
Because we don't think it's good to sell the forest.
How old are you?
I'm 12.
Have you lived here all your life?
Yeah.
What about you? How old are you?
15.
And what do you think about all this?
I think it's really horrible because our dogs are walked here and everything, and it's nice to just go walk in. And it's, I don't know, I don't think they have the right to sell it off.
Is this particular land we're standing on one of the areas they're going to sell?
I'm not sure. I don't know that. I think this land is owned by Speech House, but a lot of the areas around it are areas they're going to sell.
So they've got these long poles now, and they're putting them into the flames. They're igniting them as a taper, and they're going to use this to set fire to the structure. Hello, why are you here today?
Because I love the forest, Dean.
Are you from the forest?
Yes, I am. And I don't think that it should be sold off for some rich man's plaything. It's an important... Well, I can't speak very well. I'm just so angry about it. We just get betrayed. Whoever we have in government, they betray us.
It's all to do with money, do you think?
Yes, definitely. Greed and money. And after all, that is their doing, all of it. We can't live on money. It's like an old Indian proverb. Once the last tree has been cut down and the last river run dry, will man realise we cannot live on money alone? And that's what's going to happen here.
Well, that's what's happened to the Red Indians, isn't it? Yeah. They've had all their land sold.
Exactly. And this is what they're trying to do here. The Forest of Dean is worth fighting for, and we will fight for it, whatever that takes.
Oh, this is very medieval looking. Oh, I see. They've got a pound sign on the taper. Hello? Why are you here?
To support the forest.
Are you a forest person?
Yes.
How long have you lived here?
All my life.
And you were born in the forest, were you?
Born in Lydney.
And what was it like then, when you were little?
Beautiful. Still is beautiful.
Do you think there's any hope?
Oh, I hope so. Yes, I hope so.
Will you personally be affected by it in Lydney?
I don't live in Lydney now.
Oh, where do you live now?
In Colford.
Oh, right.
So we've lived in this area all our lives.
There's a very strong community here, isn't there?
Yes, yes.
Well, the top of the tower's burning now. There's quite a few people here today.
Somebody should do that with the real Houses of Parliament, with all of them in it. Shoot them, kill, do whatever. They betray all of us. I'll never vote ever again. I will never vote again, never. I know women died for me to have the vote, but I will never, ever vote again after this.
What about Jonathan Porritt? He's spoken here today.
No one. I don't trust anyone. No politicians anymore. That's it. I've had it.
Well, the tower's burning quite nicely now. It's quite dramatic, isn't it? Woo-hoo! Why are you here today?
Because this is my inheritance here, the inheritance of my children, and nobody has the right to take it away. The forest is beautiful and it should remain as well managed as it is. It creates an income that it generates more than it takes to manage the area. It makes absolutely no sense to me. Any part of it should be sold or treated any differently than it or has already been done so.
Do you think the politicians have misjudged the strength and spirit of the forest people?
Yes, I'm not actually a forester myself. I came here about 12 years ago. I do think the feeling will grow. I think they haven't anticipated, you know, how well informed that they would be.
So what do you think Dennis Potter would say if he was alive?
I think he'd be absolutely horrified. He must be turning in his grave. Yeah.
The tower is burning away merrily now, and there's flames pouring out the top of it. We're just left with the clock face of Big Ben still, and it's lovely and warm as it's snowing round about us. Oh, it's going now. The whole structure's dropping. The clock face of Big Ben's finally gone. We're just left with a bit of the tower.
That was Anthea Page there, outside the Speech House in the Forest of Dean, where Hands of Our Forest rally was being held last week. If you are concerned about the future of our forests and the outcome of the Public Bodies Bill, you can support the Hoof campaign by writing to Mark Harper MP at the House of Commons, London, SW1A OAA, or phone 01594 823 482. For more details about the campaign, visit www.handsoffourforest.org. Hands of Our Forest is all one word, and they are based at Elwood Lodge in Little Drybrook, Colford, and the postcode for that is GL16 8LP. So use that address if you'd like to get some more information.
Many of the people at the rally there in the Forest of Dean were holding yellow ribbons tied with a bow. The yellow ribbon was taken to America by the English settlers and were used by the Puritans during the English Civil War, who wore yellow ribbons and sashes on the battlefield. Yellow is the official colour of the armour brand of the US Army. In the military, it was used in a popular marching song.
Coming home, I've done my time. Now I've got to know what is and isn't mine. If you receive my letter telling you I'd soon be free, then you'll know just what to do if you still want me. If you still want me. What time? Forget about us, put the blame on me. If I don't see a yellow ribbon round the old oak tree. Bus driver, please look for me, 'cause I couldn't bear to see what I might see. I'm really still in prison and my love, she holds. Stay on the bus, forget about us, put the blame on me. If I don't see a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree.
Well, that song, Tie Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree, not to be confused with the lyrics Tie Yellow Gibbon Round the Old Oak Tree, as written by the Goodies, was written by Irwin Levine and L. Russell Brown, and was recorded by Tony Orlando and Dawn. In May 1973, it sold 3 million copies in 3 weeks. You know, thank God punk hit in 1976, otherwise we'd be still listening to it. Released convicts in America would look for the yellow ribbon tied to a tree outside their home, which meant they were welcomed back into the family circle. Now you know.
In a few weeks' time, we're going to bring you a very exciting weekly reading of Treasure Island with the fabulous voice of Malcolm Greaves. So in the run-up to this, Alec Milne has recorded some of Robert Louis Stevenson's letters. You can find out all about the author in the Writers' Museum, Edinburgh, and they have connections with the Robert Louis Stevenson Society, who have visited his home in Monterey, America.
Selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Thomas Stevenson and Margaret Isabella Balfour were married on the 24th of August 1848. Their only child, Robert Louis Stevenson, or Robert Louis Balfour, as he was baptised, was born on the 13th of November 1850 at 8 Howard Place, Edinburgh. Thomas Stevenson was the youngest of the five children who survived infancy of Robert Stevenson, the famous lighthouse engineer, and his wife Jean, or Jane Smith. Robert Stevenson was engineer to the Northern Lighthouse Board for nearly half a century, during which time he was mainly responsible for the inauguration of the Scottish lighthouse system. his greatest achievement being the building, under hazardous conditions, of the Bell Rock Lighthouse between 1807 and 1811. Three of his four sons, Alan, David and Thomas, joined him in the firm of civil engineers and became in their turn engineers to the Northern Lighthouse Board. Thomas was made a junior partner in 1846 after his father's retirement, and from 1853, following their father Alan's retirement due to ill health, David and Thomas ran the firm of D&T Stevenson. In addition to their major work as lighthouse engineers, the Stevensons were engaged in the construction of harbours and docks and the improvements of rivers and estuaries. Thomas Stevenson's greatest achievement as an inventor was in the field of optics, as applied to the lighthouse illumination. Thomas Stevenson was a deeply religious man, and his adherence to the harsh and gloomy doctrines of Scottish Calvinistic Christianity dominated his whole life. RLS described his father's sense of fleetingness of life and his concern for death as morbid. He had never accepted the conditions of man's life or his own character, and his inmost thoughts were ever tinged with a Celtic melancholy. Robert Louis Stevenson went to school for the first time on the 30th of September 1857 to Mr. Henderson's preparatory school in India Street, Edinburgh. He did not stay for more than a few weeks and was not well enough to return until 1859, in October. During his many absences, he was taught by private tutors. On 1 October 1861, he went to Edinburgh Academy and stayed there, with interruptions, for about 15 months. In the autumn of 1863, when his mother was at Mentone, he studied one term at an English boarding school in Isleworth, Middlesex. By this time, his health had shown considerable improvement, and in 1864, he resumed his regular education in Edinburgh at Robert Thompson's private school in Frederick Street. He continued there until he went to university. A number of childish letters survive, beginning with one to his father, dictated to his mother when he was 3 years old. This show a lively, imaginative and much-loved child on close and happy terms with his parents. Many of them were written to his father, who was frequently away from home on business. A number were written when he was unhappy at boarding school. "My dear Papa, you told me to tell you when I was miserable. I do not feel well and wish to get home." Stevenson was enrolled as a student at Edinburgh University in November 1867, and for the next 3.5 years began dutifully, if half-heartedly, to prepare himself for the family profession. During summer months, an attempt was made to teach him something of the practical side of the engineering business. The first letter concerns his stay in Wick in 1868, where the firm was carrying out harbour works, and his visit to the Isle of Eraid in 1870, when Dhu Hirtach Lighthouse was being built. To his mother, Saturday, the 5th of September, 1868, Wick. "My dear mother, to go on with my description, Wick lies at the end or elbow of an open triangular bay, hemmed on either side by shores, either cliff or steep earth bank, of no great height. The grey houses of Pountney extend along the southerly shore almost to the cape, and it is about halfway down this shore, no 6/7 way down that the new breakwater extends athwart the bay. Certainly Wick in itself possesses no beauty. Bare grey shores, grim grey houses, grim grey sea, not even the gleam of red tile, not even the greenness of a tree. The southerly heights when I came here were black with people, fishers waiting on the wind and night. Now all the SY, that's the Stornoway boats, have all beaten out of the bay, and the Wick men stay indoors or wrangle on the quays with dissatisfied fish curers, knee-high in brine, mud and herring refuse. The day when the boats put out to go home to the Hebrides, the girl here told me there was a black wind and on going out I found the epithet as justifiable as it was picturesque. A cold, black, southerly wind, with occasional rising of showers. It is a fine sight to see the boats beating out a teeth of it. In Wick, I have never heard anyone greet his neighbour with the usual fine day or good morning. Both come shaking their heads and both say breezy, breezy. And such is the atrocious quality of the climate that the remark is almost invariably justified by the fact. The streets are full of Highland fishers, lubberly, stupid, inconceivably lazy and heavy to move. You bruise against them, tumble over them, elbow them out against the wall. All to no purpose. They will not budge, and you are forced to leave the pavement every step. To the south, however, is as fine a piece of coast scenery as ever I saw. Great black chasms, huge black cliffs, rugged and overhung gullies, natural arches and deep green pools below them, almost too deep to let you see the gleam of sand among the darker weed. There are deep caverns, too. In one of these lives a tribe of gypsies. The men are always drunk, simply and truthfully always, from morning to evening. The great villainous-looking fellows are either sleeping off the last debauch or hulking about in the cove in the horrors. The cave is deep, high and airy, and might be made more comfortable enough. But they just live among heaped boulders, damp with continual droppings from above, with no more furniture than two or three tin pans and a truss of rotten straw and a few ragged cloaks. In the winter the surf bursts into the mouth and often forces them to abandon it. This is the Ides, and to all intents and purposes said Ides have passed. Still, there is a good deal of disturbance, many drunk men and a double supply of police. I saw them sent for by some people and enter an inn in a pretty good hurry. What was it for? I do not know. You would see by Papa's letter about the carpenter who fell off the staging. I don't think I ever saw so much excitement in my life. The man was back at his work, and I asked him how he was. But he was a Highlander, and, need I add it? Dickens a word could I understand of his answer. What is still worse, I find the people hereabout, that is to say, the Highlanders, not the Northmen, don't understand me. Have you seen or heard any more of the Americans? I have lost a shilling's worth of postage stamps, which has damped my ardour for buying lots of them. I'll buy them one at a time, as I want them for the future. The Free Church minister I got quite thick. He left me last night about 2 in the morning. When I went to turn in, he gave me the enclosed. I remain your affectionate son, R. L. Stevenson.
Thanks there to Alec Milne for that.
And it's time, complete with a grandiose theme tune, specially commissioned and made for us for The World This Week with Julian Parry.
Well, hello. Well, The World This Week has just seen the coldest month and the coldest Christmas we have seen in many, many years. I remember 1963 and 1961, and very cold they were, and it went on for a lot longer than today. But we are told that it was the coldest December for 150 years, or something like that. Now, the meteorologists have also told us why it happened. They say that the jet stream, instead of coming straight across the Atlantic, went up the eastern seaboard of America and Canada, through the Arctic Circle, and came down again south before turning a hard left across to the east and bringing us all that snow and weather which caused so much disruption. And we have to all ask ourselves this week, whatever happened to global warming? How does it all fit together? Well, one of the things that we're being told now is to fear for the future. We're always being told to be fearful, and this time it's about the Atlantic Conveyor. That's the Gulf Stream which comes up from the equator, brings us a lot of heat that makes us a nice warm country, because we'd be as cold as Labrador if it wasn't there. But we're also told that because it's got so warm in the world, and there's so much heat in the world generally, that suddenly the ice caps are melting, and that's putting fresh water into the Arctic Circle in a place called the Weddell Sea. And because the Weddell Sea is got fresh water in it, it's no longer saline, so the water doesn't sink, so the water doesn't return, and so we don't get the circulation to bring the hot water up from the equator. Well, to be quite honest with you, when we look at that, and nobody else has mentioned this ever, it looks to me like that's a bit of a thermostat. So really, should we be too troubled if suddenly it gets cold in the Arctic and we got saline and then we get the heat up from the equator? But if it gets too hot in the Arctic and we get a lot of fresh water there, then the thermostat turns the supply of heat off and we can go cool again, as we have done recently. So there's a lot to think about there. And perhaps one of the meteorologists out there and some of the other earth scientists out there might like to call in and comment upon this possibility. But all the time we're being told that carbon dioxide is the great big problem, and that there's so much carbon dioxide that that's what's building up the heat. Well, I saw some maps the other day that were on an interactive website that looked at temperatures across decades, and I couldn't help noticing that between 1930 and 1939, Greenland was as bright red and as warm as it is today, although admittedly they've got a lot more heat in other parts of the world. But then I remembered Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth and the hockey stick graph. Do you all remember the hockey stick graph, which they don't use anymore? Well, it turns out that the hockey stick graph was made out of two data sets. The shaft was made out of data obtained from tree rings, whereas the blade was made out of data taken from thermometers. And you might think, well, the thermometers have got to be accurate. And then you find out that those thermometers in those weather stations were increasingly surrounded by buildings in the urban area, and some of them were even moved onto tarmac and concrete floors, which of course raised the temperatures 4 or 5 degrees centigrade. So when we are told that we've got more heat in the world today, and when we've got all the cold weather that we've had in the last few weeks, maybe the truth is that the data we're getting that says there's a lot of heat in the world isn't quite as accurate as it should be. Are there anybody out there who would like to comment on this?
Next up, we've got Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. Hey, Trevor.
Hi there, Michaela.
What have you got for us today?
Well, whilst just sitting, listening to the previous conversation, I was thinking about Miriam O'Reilly. Did you hear the news today that she's won her case for unfair dismissal against the BBC?
Yes, I did hear that.
So I've just been making a few notes on that whilst I've been waiting.
Let's have it.
So this is what I've written. Congratulations to Miriam O'Reilly, who has embarrassed the BBC. But whose victory is this, really? Whose money is paying the fee? It's not those who made the decision who will have to pick up the bill. I prefer not to think too much about it. The injustice just makes me feel ill. Still, congratulations to Miriam O'Reilly. I do think she's done really well, but will her victory make any difference, or will it just leave a bad smell?
Hot off the pen there, Trevor.
Hot off the pen. So anyway, that was just something I noted while I was waiting, really. But
so do you
it's not bad, is it? It's not bad for 10 minutes.
No,
but anyway,
yeah, pretty good.
This is the one that I was going to read last week, which I lost.
But you found.
But it's fine. Anyways, I think it's just in time. It's about making plans in the new year. You know, it's what we do. Think about the year ahead and how we're going to manage it. Making plans. Now is the time for making plans, to cast wantings into resolutions, ensure a plan of action stands, review details of our constitutions. We make our lists to sort our aims, to better serve our greater good, condense intentions into frames that guide us through life's brambled wood. The reference points of our resolve we trust to light the way ahead, through tempting tracts that will evolve to take us somewhere else instead. The best of plans have passed by dates when brave intentions are outdated and can't foretell which future fates will make them all seem overrated. Perhaps the best of man-made plans should be enacted only when we've reconsidered all demands, including those who are not men. Agendas of the genders clash as do the ones of age and race. So much planning ends as mash and dissolves in our divine disgrace, and resolutions seem self-centred in the context of the outer mess. Though misfortunes cannot be prevented, we must cultivate a receptiveness. Make more from less, have less of more, accept our blessings and make do, for all we have is so much more than what we need to see us through. That's not to say we should not try, for not to just won't do at all. We should make plans and not be shy. The unresolved are bound to fall. And so we must be resolute, though planning may appear a pain. And when our dreams go down the pan, we'll stoop and fish them out again. Thank you.
Thank you, Trevor. Yeah. Do you have any events that you'd like to...
Yes, I do. Oh, it's a good job you mentioned that. I had a message from my co-poet, Tim, and Tim has asked me to mention that there's a gig at the Lansdowne in Clifton on Thursday the 20th, and it's three acts for £4 on the door. So that's it, really. He didn't actually tell me what time it is. I expect it'll be about 7:30. As for me, we're planning a romantic event next month for Valentine's at the Grant Bradley Gallery, where I'm the poet in residence. Further details about that nearer the time, I think.
Okay, we'll look out for that then.
Okay.
Thanks, Trevor.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for Jess Sparks. I initially thought he'd turned up legless, but it turns out he's just wearing camouflage trousers.
Boom, boom.
Please, take the mic away from me. What's going on this week?
Thank you. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting on Friday, 21st of January, Hip Root will be performing with support from Willie and the Bandits and also Pig Nose at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving into Saturday, 22nd of January, the ZZ Tops will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £6 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Ray Davis. In 2010, he collaborated with various musicians and they crafted new versions of his classic songs. The album is titled See My Friends, and this is the song You Really Got Me, which features Metallica.
Do it.
That was Ray Davies and Metallica performing the song You Really Got Me from the album See My Friends. For more information, you can check out www.raydavies.info. Keeping with Saturday, 22nd of January, No More Heroes will be performing at the Reckless Engineer Temple Gate in Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Into Sunday, 23rd of January, the Sleepy Dogs will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Monday, 24th of January, TSOL will be performing with support from Valdez at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. Noticed in the latest edition of Classic Rock magazine, they've got an interview with Dave Davies, the brother of Ray, of course, and he said he met Jimi Hendrix in the first class section of a flight abroad, and Hendrix apparently turned to him and said, "You know, you really got me?" And that was a real landmark, man. And he was very chuffed with himself and thought it was absolutely amazing. Out now in the shops, ladies and gentlemen.
That's all from Dialect this week. Thanks to our studio guests, Martin Maudsley and Julian Parry. Features were by Anthea Page and Alec Milne. And Alec Milne also read the letters of Robert Louis Stevenson.
Thanks to Tony Gosling as ever. The poem was read by Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and the What's Horn was by Jess Barks. Engineer was Michael Noyce. The producer was Anthea Page. The presenters were Michaela Dennis
and John Peters Coleman.
So until next week, goodbye.
I talk to the trees, but they don't listen to me. I talk to the stars, but they never hear me. The breeze hasn't time to stop and hear what I say. I talk to them all in vain. But suddenly my words reach someone else's ear. That someone else's heart strings too. Tell you my dreams, and while you're listening to me, I suddenly see them come true. I can see us on an April night, looking out across a rolling farm, having supper in the candlelight, walking later, arm in arm. Then I'll tell you how I pass the day, thinking mainly how the night would be. Then I'll try to find the words to say all the things you mean to me. I tell you my dream, and while you're listening to me, I suddenly see him come true.